From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, Michael Williams, CBS Radio News contributor here in Washington, D.C. Joining me on the panel this week are Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Abdulrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief, Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson wraps up a visit to South Asia and the Middle East, where he hoped to make strides in ending one war and preventing another. The United States considers sanctions against Myanmar because of ongoing violence against the Rohingya minority. Refugee resettlement will be allowed again in the U.S., but on a much smaller scale and with stricter screening regulations. And on the U.S. political front, a widening rift among Republicans and the Republican administration explodes into a public dispute between the U.S. president and two of the senators that he will need to pass his legislative agenda. Let's start with Rex Tillerson and his visit. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson went on a five-day, six-nation tour that tackled several of the world's most sensitive issues, including preventing Afghanistan from falling back into chaos, relations and tensions between Kurdish and the Iraqis, using India's relationship with North Korea as a pathway for diplomatic resolution to the tensions between the United States and North Korea, and on and on. As I say, it's a very ambitious agenda that he laid out. Laura, in your view, what were the hits, if any, of this trip, and what were the misses?
Well, I just think the most striking thing that happened on the trip was his visit to Pakistan, where he, you know, yet again tried to send a tough message to Pakistan, saying essentially that they needed to stop funding and providing shelter to terror groups that the U.S. has long believed that the Pakistani government is essentially sheltering and supporting. And the, you know, Pakistan has essentially, flouted U.S. wishes on that for many years. And I think Tillerson had a bit of a swagger about him when he said it, sort of a this must stop now kind of attitude, which is understandable. But on the other hand, you know, or what? You know, the U.S. needs Pakistan, of course, to support the war in Afghanistan. And there's really not, we've been in this between this rock and a hard place with Pakistan for so many years, really since 9/11. It's not really clear what Tillerson or anyone else can do to force Pakistan to do what we want in terms of the war on terror. So I just think it was striking that he went out and said that. And also at the same time in his trip to India, you know, really kind of cozied up to the Indians and made clear that that was a very strong U.S. relationship. I'm sure, you know, Pakistan didn't exactly love that. So I'm just not really sure where this leaves us at the end of the day.
Abdulrahim, Laura makes some very good points about sort of this balancing act that has to go on between India and Pakistan and sort of this triangulation that goes on historically with the United States. And it is a very delicate balancing act, even for the most experienced of diplomats. In your opinion, has Rex Tillerson in his new diplomatic role here, would you say that he has actually made any progress here? Has he helped or hindered this balance and progress between these relationships?
Well, I think that one of the most important things from the point of view of Rex Tillerson in particular, but the Donald Trump administration as a whole, it's very important for them to say where the line in the sand, so to speak, is. But like Laura said, the issue with Pakistan, the United States throughout, you know, several administrations now has been in a position where it cannot live with Pakistan, it cannot live without Pakistan. It has to be said that part of the concern, obviously, for the United States is that Pakistan is a nuclear power. And there's a lot of concern that if Pakistan goes completely unstable and government falls in the wrong hands from the point of view of the United States, Pakistan being a nuclear power, that's going to be a very dicey situation. But there's also a flip side to the coin, which is that the Pakistanis also see themselves as a nuclear power who should not be bullied. And they're actually saying, we are very important and we need to be treated as equal partners by the United States rather than be dictated to. And given the long history of the Cold War between India and Pakistan, the Pakistanis have always been on the side of China. China supports them because, you know, there's been friction between China and India. But at the same time, when you hear Rex Tillerson and the Trump administration putting so much emphasis on long-term relations with India, as Laura said, that's bound to frazzle the Pakistanis.
Laura, we have these long-standing balancing acts, again, between China, India, North Korea also figures into the mix. And yet we have stories coming out this week about the State Department being run by just a handful of sort of handpicked aides rather than by the usual group of diplomats that is handling the situation. Again, we still don't have an ambassador to South Korea, given the fact that Tillerson regime, if you will, is so lightly staffed and roughly inexperienced. Do you think that this type of minimalist attitude is really going to be successful with this type of agenda?
Well, you know, I don't know if it'll be successful or not, but I will say that this concerns about personnel and staffing at the State Department have been going on for months now. There's been somewhat of an exodus of career officials and not an inflow of new people to take those jobs. People who, my colleagues who cover the State Department, tell me that, you know, his inner circle is very insular, that there isn't a sense from the career staff who are there that they're reaching out and working with them. And that's a problem because, I mean, we're not talking about a political agenda. We're not talking about all of the things that most of the agencies do, you know, that kind of come and go with the tides of politics. I mean, obviously, all agencies need continuity. But in this one in particular, when you're dealing with the world, you really need the expertise of these diplomats and all of these bureaus. And so, yes, there's been a lot of concern about the lack of staffing. And I don't know how quickly that will resolve. Presumably it will. But we are, you know, we're coming upon the anniversary of the election. The end of the year will be here soon. So, you know, we're moving our way through this term.
Let's move on to Myanmar and the Rohingya crisis. Last year, Aleppo was kind of the focus of the world's attention with the violence and suffering that happened in that city. It was a lead story for many weeks on this particular show. This year, it's Myanmar and the exodus of the Rohingya people. Abdul Rahim, could you give a sort of framework for this? Who exactly are the Rohingya people, and why has their situation in Myanmar become so untenable so quickly?
Let me, first of all, just express an idea about how it's amazing that we as media basically can decide which particular crisis we want to focus on this year and which particular crisis we don't want to focus on next year. The situation in Syria, in many parts of Syria, is just as dire today for civilians as it was last year.
Yeah,
and yet
right.
We
yep.
seem to have moved on to deal with other crises, which are just as tragic, like the one in Burma. Now, in Burma, the Rohingya are basically a Muslim minority, and it's a crisis that has been going on in that country for a long, long time. One of the flashpoints of the Rohingya situation was actually in the early 1990s, and there was an exodus similar to what we're seeing today from Burma to Bangladesh by the Rohingya, except this time it's different in the sense that recently we've had 600,000 Rohingya Muslims basically leave Burma to Bangladesh. And that has compounded the situation in Bangladesh in general, but it's compounded the situation on the conditions of the Rohingya refugees already established for a long time in Bangladesh. The other new, sort of new element in this tragedy is that from the point of view of the military in Burma, they are saying that basically they are dealing with extremists within the Rohingya Muslim community in Burma, and that's why they've been taking the measures that they have been taking to weed out the extremists. But, you know, this is a line that we hear almost from every closed regime when it comes to dealing with internal problems. And the community as a whole, the Rohingya community as a whole, has ended up paying the price in terms of attacks on them in Burma, but also in terms of being forced to leave Burma and to seek asylum and refuge in Bangladesh.
I mean, you make a very good point about, number one, about the tragedy du jour that we choose as a media, and also about where a government decides to draw the line in the sand as to what's acceptable in a people and what's not. I'm going to read really quickly the Trump administration's statement regarding this. I think some of the wording is interesting. The government of Burma, including its armed forces, must take immediate action to ensure peace and security, implement commitments to ensure humanitarian access to communities in desperate need, facilitate the safe and voluntary return of those who have fled or been displaced, and address the root causes of systemic discrimination against the Rohingya. I'm going to say, Laura, do you think we talk about carrot and stick in terms of how we can deal with countries and making asks? And you made that point in terms of Pakistan. What is the carrot and stick situation for Myanmar? What does the U.S. actually want them to do? And do we have any way, any leverage to make them actually do it?
Well, what we want them to do is stop what the U.N. has called, you know, textbook example of genocide and ethnic cleansing. I mean, first of all, I just want to push back a little bit on the earlier conversation, you know, the idea that the media is sort of flitting in and out of these stories. And obviously there's some truth to that. But I think the reason why the media is focused right now on this is that it is a horrible humanitarian situation where there are people who are just being slaughtered. So, yeah, I think that's why we're focused. Can the U.S. do anything about it? Yes. This week there was talk for the first time. The Trump administration threatened sanctions, economic sanctions. Now, that, of course, is interesting. We just lifted them a year ago. You know, we had had sanctions on the country we called Burma for 50 years before, with great pomp and circumstance, President Obama opened up our relationship with the country. The military rulers there appeared willing to turn the corner and start a new day. And it was a lot of new Western investment flooded into the country. And it looked like that country was kind of joining the world community. And all was well until, oh, well, they've got this ethnic minority that they all hate. They just hate them, and they think they have no rights, if you look at all the coverage. So what they're talking about doing now is imposing sanctions. 40 lawmakers have called from the House have called on for economic sanctions to be reimposed on these military leaders who run the country. Of course, major question about Aung San Suu Kyi, who has been lauded for her efforts to promote peace and in her country and doesn't appear to be doing a lot right now in terms of taking on the military that truly still is in charge of the country. So it's a mess there. The question is, you know, how tough this U.S. wants to be on sanctions and whether that will make a difference in a place where clearly they view the situation of the Rohingya quite different than the rest of the world does.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back to this issue. One more question I'd like to throw out to the panel. This is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. I am your moderator, Michael Williams, CBS Radio News contributor here in Washington, along with our panelists, Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. You can also hear the program on our Facebook page, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Just the last question I sort of want to throw out there is that the refugee crisis from Syria last year was, some think, is the thin edge of the wedge for a wave of populism that spread across Western Europe and the U.S., the idea of not in our backyard, you know, refugee crisis. It's a shame what happened, but we don't want them here. Is there any possibility, Abdurrahim, of that type of long-term consequence with the hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of refugees that are flooding into Bangladesh, a country that clearly can't afford to say, hold that amount of refugee population?
Well, I mean, just as a general principle, refugees always take with them their trail of tragedy for themselves first, but also for places, other places where they seek refuge. I mean, if you just look at the issues that Bangladesh, the hosting country for Rohingya refugees, has had to deal with, that gives you an insight into the size of the problem. problem and into the size of the tragedy of the Rohingya Muslims. But, you know, one difference, obviously, between Burma and Syria is geography. Syria, because of its location, people can very easily, take that with a grain of salt, transit from Syria through Turkey into Europe. Then it becomes an issue in Germany, it becomes an issue in France. It became an issue in the United Kingdom, and in many ways, if you believe what some of the Brits say, it contributed to the British exit from the European Union. I'm not sure to what extent the issue of the Rohingya at this particular point in time carries the seas of that kind of scale as the scale of the Syrian refugees. But for the Rohingya themselves, whether they are inside Burma or in Bangladesh, it's obviously a very, very, very acute tragedy.
It is an acute tragedy, and I'm sure that's one we will be talking about in the weeks and months to come. Let's move to, actually, it's a pretty easy segue to the Trump administration stance on refugees. Refugee settlement, again, will be allowed again in the U.S., but on a much smaller scale and with some stricter screening regulations. U.S. President Donald Trump had signed an executive order earlier this year that included a 120-day ban on refugees entering the United States. That ban was to end on October 24th, but the administration has since imposed a new set of restrictions, setting roadblocks for refugees hoping for sanctuary in the United States. Laura, can you tell us a little bit about what the framework is for those restrictions and what the rationale is for the administration?
Yeah, I mean, there's two pieces to this. So on one hand, you essentially have the administration arguing that refugees are not have not been vetted sufficiently, that essentially that the partly because there isn't a lot of information always available about people who are filing these applications, that we need stricter and tougher vetting. So those, a bunch of new rules are taking effect. You know, they have to give more information. There's going to be more mining of the types of stuff that applicants post on social media. More people are going to get security checks. But I actually think that's the less significant part of what they said. What they also said was that 11 countries, including many in the Middle East and North Africa, are going to essentially be put on hold for another 90 days. Now, it doesn't mean that none can get in, but in order to get in from one of those countries, you're going to have to prove that your entrance into this country is in the national interest, which I think is a pretty high bar. They've said that they're going to prioritize applications from the other countries that are not on this list of 11, that they are going to essentially slow roll the consideration of applicants from all these countries. In these countries, where are they? It's the places that you would think, you know, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia. 63% of refugees who enter this country come from those 11 countries. So there is essentially an extension of the refugee ban, again, with some exceptions to it, but it is essentially being extended for a great number of people. And then for the others, these new rules are being put into effect. And of course, as we know, the Trump administration has dropped the number that we intend to admit this year to a maximum of 45,000.
A great point made by Laura. I guess it sort of boils down to this, Abdulrahim. Do you think that refugees are being used as a political football by the Trump administration? Or are these sanctions and these hurdles for refugees to jump through, are they somehow legitimate?
The issue of refugees in the United States in particular, the way I see it, is it's a very vexing problem. Because the world is confounded by the fact that the United States, a country built by immigrants, built for refugees, by refugees at the outset, is now telling refugees, look, we're going to really tighten the screws. And it's almost the issue of refugees has, at least in the eyes of, you know, people in outside the United States, it has become an issue of an administration, whether this is right or wrong, but this is basically the prism through which the Muslim world looks at it. It has become an issue of the United States discriminating against Muslims rather than discriminating against refugees. Obviously, for the Trump administration, it's saying it has nothing to do with discrimination. It all has to do with the national security of the United States, and that's how they want to focus on it. But what the Trump administration is saying about those countries, although not naming them by name, is that basically countries where risk, security risk, has traditionally originated. And some of those countries are allies of the United States. I mean, we're not just talking about countries like Iran, which is a foe of the United States. We're talking about Egypt, for example, a close ally of the United States. So it's obviously a very complicated issue. The bottom line for me is that this president, when he was running for election, that's one of the tickets that he ran on, the issue of tightening the screws and dealing with refugees in a world of widespread terrorism, as he said. And you mentioned Syria. The fear, obviously, is that refugees, is that terrorists would come in as refugees to do harm inside the United States. But so far, history tells us that the risk that refugees coming to the United States have carried with them has been very, 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 very minimal. And most of the attacks, terrorist attacks that happens here, that have happened here in the United States, most of them are actually by people born in the United States.
It's mostly homegrown. That's exactly true. I agree with you. This is a thing that tells the world how the United States feels about it. You know, at some point, it's a very clear message as to what our stance is to the rest of the world, what our position is, and what we think of ourselves as Americans, that what the U.S. thinks of itself as a country. Whether or not you agree with it, I think it sends a pretty clear message as to how the administration feels about the refugees and their comings and goings. We just have a couple of minutes, and I just want to touch on really quickly the sort of Republican feud that broke out into a public, a kind of a political food fight between the U.S. President Donald Trump and U.S. Senators Jeff Flake of Nevada and Bob Corker of Tennessee, two guys who would you could call nothing more than conservative Republicans, establishment Republicans, who started leveling harsh criticism this past week at the president. The president returned the favor on his Twitter account. And just really quickly, Laura, do you think that this sort of pushback from two senators who are leaving, both of whom are leaving the Senate, do you think this is the beginning of a broad uprising in the GOP trying to sort of face down the president and his Twitter account? Or is it just sort of a lot of noise being made by two guys who are on the way out the door?
I think what they said, that there are a lot of people in their party who agree with what they said, but there is a lot of fear of saying anything critical of the president, because not only will he go after you, but, you know, the Republican base is with the president. So, you know, he may not have a majority approval in the country, but he has a overwhelming approval among base loyal Republican Party voters.
80% among registered Republicans.
So then the question becomes, you know, if you're against the president and then those and then you don't have the base with you, then you're extremely vulnerable. So if you really, on one hand, it is very striking what we heard from Jeff Flake when he announced he wasn't running and he then went after the president in just sweeping terms. Same thing with Bob Corker. But you know, they really are the only two voices in Congress that have voiced that kind of critique of the president, maybe a little bit from John McCain every so often. Another person is probably not running for re-election and is obviously quite ill.
Battling
brain cancer. So I think that when you look at it, I think you only can conclude that the bulk of the party is, in fact, with President Trump right now. And, you know, maybe that changes at some point. But right now, I think he is winning the day.
Abdur-Rahim, I got about 1 minute. Do you think that there will be a senator this week who is actually running for re-election who will oppose the president openly, as Flake and Corker has done? Or will they sort of keep towing the party line for fear of having a primary challenge from the right, from the Tea Party, as it's become? That's a capital T, the Trump Party, which the GOP has become.
I think if you still have a dog in the race, it's going to be obviously very difficult for anyone to go openly against Donald Trump, particularly as Steve Bannon, he's a former top advisor, is very active trying to warn Republicans against any dissent, open dissent against Donald Trump. But ultimately, when you hear even some of those members of Congress, Republicans, who are who say that they still support Donald Trump, when you listen to them, particularly when you listen to them on radio, because radio filters sentiments much better than television, you feel that although they, many of them still express support for Donald Trump, feel that, you know, their defense of their position is not really heartfelt. They feel that what Corker and Flake said maybe does actually speak for a larger number of Republicans than we have seen speak in public.
Well, as they say, objects in rearview mirror are closer than they appear, and the 2018 midterm elections are closer than they seem. They are upon us, so we will be revisiting this at some point. But that's all the time that we have for today. Thanks to Abdur-Rahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV, and Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio News contributor here in Washington. Thanks for listening.